Very good, very good.
Good. Good days and bad days. Hopefully, Keith's wife is more good days than me in the old days, you know. So.
You talking about yourself or me?
Well, in general, I guess human plight, you know, in the context of survival. So, good mental health, we'll say. Who knows, you know. I'm being very formal just because we haven't been able to converse in a while. I thought that your website was Purple Tellurian, and I tried to reach you email through there, and then I guess 5body.com was pretty much it. So I will say I've caught a few things on YouTube. I'm sorry I couldn't be a part of the 2005 world tour there. I know that that must have been very, you know, very interesting. So, you know, so.
That's it. That was good. I'm moving to Maui this week, next week.
What brought that on? Something to do with Carolyn's work or just change of environment? Or?
No, it's connected. Carolyn's been offered a medical directorship of a new awesome spa in Costa Rica.
Right.
And the people that are designing it are in Maui, so we're going to go live and work with them while it's built over the next 2 years.
Oh, killer, man. Killer. That's fabulous, man. That is so fabulous. You know, I don't even know where to start, Bob. There's so many topics to approach. You know, I will say that the medium of YouTube is basically old information retrieved in what they allegedly called the new medium under the electronic, you know, basic visual acoustic space means. And what's the saying talking about how someday the internet, with all its possibilities, will more or less eat itself? It's more of a pendulum swing of a new technology bringing forth so many potential things. But at the same time, Zappa even made a quote to it, says, well, here we have, you know, video cameras and all these ways to really have an individual express artistic freedom, and what do they do with it? Is it more or less shoot porn, you know? I mean, you're familiar with that quote, or what?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, right on. Right on. What piqued my interest recently, because I know, you know, back early 90s, in one of our first encounters, your fascination with Bob Dylan, and Spacey had his project, and then there was another movie, Don't Look Back. There were two Bob Dylan films, and he was, I mean, for the time, and as silly as it is by today's standards, he was a master media manipulator. Now, was he influenced by McLuhan, or did he just kind of do it trial and error? I mean, he literally had all the media, international stardom, eating out of the palm of his hand. So where did he get this knowledge to more or less be able to handle it as well as he did for a young 20-year-old man? You know, by the way, his birthday was, I believe, yesterday or the day before. He was 67, I believe.
Okay, so now don't talk until I tell you to talk. Let me respond to all that you've said.
Sure.
Have you seen I'm Not There?
The Dylan movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's an excellent movie. I'm going to do a commentary on it eventually and be on my website. But, okay, Dylan said in 1985 in Spin magazine in an interview that if you want to understand the 60s, I'm eating some rice puffs, so the dryness makes me cough a bit, but I gotta eat something. Anyways, he said in that interview, if you want to understand the 60s, read Norm Mailer and Marshall McLuhan. So, there's the indication he's aware of McLuhan and his relevance to understanding the 60s. He also met McLuhan in March, early 1974, when Dylan did his comeback tour.
Right.
And there's an article in Rolling Stone magazine, I think it's by Ben Fong Torres. And Michael McClure, the beatnik poet, took McLuhan to a concert in Toronto, a Dylan concert. And he reported that McLuhan, all the way through the concert, kept screaming, "Acoustic space has no centers and boundaries nowhere." He kept yelling the characteristics of electric acoustic space. That's all he did. He kept trying to fight the whole volume of concert noise with his aphorisms and his maxims and laws. And then he went backstage and met Dylan. So I don't know what was said or what Dylan picked up on, but there is definitely a McLuhan-Dylan thing. Now, I say that Dylan in... you haven't seen I'm Not There.
I have seen it, but not recently.
Okay, well, remember, it focuses on the motorcycle accident.
Yeah, if I recall, it is, yeah, very much mentioned in that, yeah.
It begins and ends with the motorcycle accident. And so that's his peak period. Later in Rolling Stone in 1969, his first interview with Jan Wenner, he said, "I should have been more aware than I was." And you can see that he did not understand the McLuhan vortex as it was happening. So he was the canary, went into it. Zappa then said Dylan went in, was doing a good job, and then blew it. So Frank had to redo Dylan with a little more conscious awareness. And he developed that media awareness, you know, through the decades. So of the baby boomers, or just before pre-baby boomers, Zappa was the closest to understanding his own image within the media vortex. In other words, he was the most McLuhan-esque, though he didn't know much about McLuhan. The little bit we... he told me years before that he read the little black book when it came out in 67, the little McLuhan, the mediumism massage. Who knows what he got from it? But in the Bob Marshall interview, he talks about, I get him to admit a bit about the mediumism message. It takes a while, but near the end of the interview, he comes around to it. But on the surface, he doesn't know that he's doing McLuhan. So I think Dylan, by now, after his fundamentalist phase, that he was a media manager, but he also didn't have to media manage. He was a meme. You know, he was a given. So I don't think Dylan ever totally figured out, and when he describes in his biography, what's called Chronicle, I heard people read sections on it, I scanned one or two pages. He was totally pissed off in the late 60s when he was hiding up in Woodstock and people were still coming around him. So he had to suffer the fame, the media burn, like everybody else does. And I say he basically didn't get out of it. He's just gone from one identity image to the next. The only reason he's big now is that he's the last guy left standing.
Right.
So I wouldn't put undue media, the McLuhan level of understanding. He might have that now, but he didn't have it when he was unfolding as Bob Dylan. Zappa had it better, but Zappa wasn't conscious of it. Zappa does not say, if you want to understand the 60s, read McLuhan and Norman Mailer. But it's interesting that Dylan does. So the dialectic between Zappa and Dylan is always interesting. Remember, we've talked about the keys Frank Dylan says in when he's after the motorcycle accident in the liner notes to John Wesley Hardy. That's a key thing. That may be when he started to realize things, you know, and maybe studied McLuhan. But... I guess I would say that. Oh, about YouTube, that's the Android meme saying the world's all about you. You can edit and create your own media spaces. You're your own Dan Rather. And so that's the charisma and fascination of the Android meme and the YouTube. YouTube is both democratic, creative, expansive, imaginative expression of everything. Of course, it's always just replaying stuff, but nobody can express the present except for me. No medium expresses the present. The medium of the present is YouTube kind of technology. What is the present that's creating? Now, anybody doing YouTube doesn't know what that present is.
Now, hold on, let's get our definition straight. When you say medium, you're talking about the actual, you being the word of being able to interpret it for the masses, or a medium through higher etheric knowledge?
No, not occult medium. I mean, once we have cars and everybody's using cars, it creates a medium, which is the gas companies, the oil tankers, the smelly streets, the highways. That's the medium. The effects that are necessary to keep the car as figure going. So the medium is the ground. Okay?
Yeah, we've used the term Android meme before.
Yeah.
I mean, refresh my memory on it, because it has been, you know, just get me up to speed, Bob, give me a few minutes, and I'll be able to get into an interesting dialect, because, yeah, there's several things that I think you'll find interesting. But redefine Android meme for me for a second.
Yeah, just before I do that, I think you had me on your radio station about 5 years ago.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, with that other guy. And you read some poetry on that. I think I found that tape. All of my audio cassettes of all of my stuff I've done, you know, since the 80s is now in my computer. I got it all digitized. So, our stuff we did in 93 and any subsequent interviews on Zappa's birthday anniversary stuff we used to do, it's all in my computer, which is great. Okay, so the Android meme is the fact that after the satellite, and we can move into the digital area, the satellite's the first extension of everything, of the whole planet, not just our particular body parts. After that, the digital technology comes in, and technology takes on a life of its own. It's not extending from us, it's extending itself. And as it extends itself through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it makes itself more seductive by appearing to disappear and allowing you, the user of the new friendly interactive media, to be the king of the media. You begin to think you're the medium. But there's a medium, a technological ground, called the Android meme that's invisible, makes itself more homeopathic and invisible. That is the medium that's making you think you're free of all media. That's the Android meme, the thing that does that.
So basically, people think that they are free from all types of media? Is that what you're more or less aspiring to or implying? Or?
Yes. Yes, the different media categories, like the radio landscape in the 20s and 30s, the TV landscape, 50s, 60s, the computer landscape in the 70s and 80s, those things have gradually shrunk and are no longer huge and massive, so people begin to think they're bigger than any previous media environments. And the Android meme is not any one particular medium, it's a seamless web of radio, TV, newspapers, books and all that, but it's all available in your palm. So it's a new effect. Just like the cell phone is not the same as the old phone that was attached to the wall. The mobility the cell phone brings in is a whole different effect than the phone that you used to have in your home and you had to sit there and talk on it. So all the old media categories that McLuhan uses have merged into one seamless web, which is extending itself and pretending that it's disappearing so that you feel that you're on top of it. So the little kid with his BlackBerry or iPhone has all media. These are all previous environments. He doesn't perceive them as environments. They're all tinier than him. And he can edit it and interact with it and scream at it, do a Jerry Springer on it. That's the superiority complex that the Android meme gives people.
Another thing, because recently Rearview Mirror Perspective, everybody wants a retrieval of this fascinating time called the 60s. And like Zappa used to joke about it, says, well, actually, it was kind of neat, but it isn't idealistic as people make it out to be, or if, you know, the phrase, if you can remember it, you weren't there, whatever, the basic rearview mirror effect or the retrieval of that nostalgia. One of the things I found interesting, because they've done several shows on John Lennon and Yoko, and basically they were fascinated through the media, you know. Yoko, this terrible woman that destroyed the man's life, and, you know, John Lennon being a very, you know, rich, excessive rock star, even though Mick Jagger used to refer to him as the governor in rock and roll. And I thought it was just ingenious how when they had a little bag in Montreal, the bed in Amsterdam, and the bag in Bagism, where they had an interview through a bag. And I mean, that was just, for the time, groundbreaking. Today, people wouldn't even blink twice about it. But that was an innovative scale that was unprecedented until that time. I mean, how did you feel at that point, you know? I mean, did you say, this is great, or this is completely idiotic, and people are buying it, you know?
Okay, you know that during that trip, they went from Amsterdam to Montreal, and then they went to Toronto to do a big festival with
Eric Clapton and
the band guy, Ronnie Hawkins.
Right, yeah, right.
Okay, while they were there, now my phone, you hear the blinking, it's going on. Do you know where the other one is? And is it in the cradle over there, Scott? Get it re-energized. This may collapse at some point. We'll see what happens there. That, are you there, Corbin?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm
okay.
Here.
So on December, like about 19th, in 1969, they visited McLuhan at his office. It was televised. You can read the transcript on the internet. Just Google McLuhan and Lennon and read what McLuhan said to him. And it's very interesting.
So he was very much in tune with McLuhan, and the medium is the message, or massage, or massage, or man the sage.
As much as he thought he understood it. In the year 2000, I spoke to Yoko Ono, and I asked her, I reminded her of her meeting with McLuhan, and I said, what did you think of what you learned, or what you got, or whatever, from McLuhan? And she said, well, I knew he was right, so I went in the opposite direction. So that's interesting. And basically, she became the founder of Women's Lib in a lot of ways. She had to recover. She was the last victim of the male star, and then she recovered it and became a pretty good artist. But she was an artist before then. But you're right, she was smeared. So she went in the opposite direction. That's interesting to analyze that. But, okay, the bag thing, that's cute, but everybody was cute back then. It's all content, and the real effects of the form was the monopoly McLuhan had. And the form turned out to be the thing to understand, and I don't think anybody understood as much as McLuhan did.
So, let's get up to speed after, man, there's several tangents we'll get off on, and if I need to call you back in just a bit, let you... digest a couple things, because obviously when we talk, I get a lot out of it, and I do want to touch on some of, you're still doing some work with Evergreens, was his name William Blake Reed?
Okay, just a second, now how do we switch over to this phone? Just press all the things and,
well, I don't know how to
press talk, I guess that, you there, Corbin?
Yeah, I'm here.
Now put the speaker on. Put the speaker, the orange thing, right there. And now speak again, Corbin.
Turn that one off.
Turn that one off. There he is, right? Speak, Corbin.
I'm speaking. I'm here. I'm not here. I'm always here. I am the only man not alive.
Now, we got to try to make this louder. I'm pressing the volume here. Is that, where's the volume? Oh, maybe you just go, there it is. Okay, speak.
Okay, so speaking one more time. Now, you just think this is more or less like a shenanigan? I mean, today if someone was, say, for instance, Ralph Nader was going to say, my next speech on the... to the White House, I'm going to do a bag in. Would take him seriously. Now, because John and Yoko were icons that were, you know, more or less media assassinated because they thought they were horrible people, even though the youth culture, you know, was totally in tune with what they were trying to accomplish. I mean, I thought that was a groundbreaking way to hold an interview. I don't think there's ever been a media interview with people in a bag where you cannot identify them. And then the innuendo was that they're doing something obscene under that bag, you know? And it had the media so intrigued, which showed how gullible the media was at that point. I mean, wouldn't you say that media, as a journalist, they are supposed to get to a story, you know, and bring content, and then ultimately user being the content. At the time, did you just thought it was a gimmick? I mean, what were your impressions?
Okay, I'm glad you bring up at the time, because what happened in January 67, I think I've told you about this, Rai, the original separateness principle, return to the plane of essence. Do you know about that?
No. You've mentioned it, but it's been a while, and like I said, you're going to need to get me up to speed on a couple things. Hold on one second. Yeah, honey, I was going to see if I could put this on speakerphone so you can hear part of what they're saying here. Okay. One second. All right, Bob, you there?
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, now... have you ever heard of Dave Worster? Did you meet him when you were in Venice?
There's a possibility.
possibility. Remind me who he was.
He had the D cell.
Well, yeah, yeah, of course. That's what I was trying to find out, because obviously any type of elixir of youth or energy, D cell, and that's Dave Worcester.
Right. I mean, Joe Dunslone made them, but Dave was the one who had them right there in Venice, and he might sell one or two to people. And Jerry was talking to Worcester. There used to be a guy on the beat, on the boardwalk, who offered about, you know, 30 little D-cell cubes that he got from Worcester.
And that's where Jerry got his, or?
No, he got his from us.
Well, yeah, because if I recall correctly, you explained the principle of it. It's a stone that collects light energy or certain types of particulate matter. I don't know if you call them photons or whatnot. Sort of the photosynthesis of a certain type, but am I technically correct me? I'm not sure what the technical lingo would be on it.
It's this, the guy who discovered it, Mr. Brown, up in Vermont in 1949, he would mix grains, certain grains together, and then look at the, and mix it, I guess, with water, and then he'd look under the microscope at the water, at the paramecium in the cells, and one day this, like, shining, emanating, lit-up cell appeared. And so he took that water and put it into ice cube trays, and then put cement in with the water and dried the water so you had a little block made of cement powder. Then you put that back in water, regular water, and it would be energized by the cell that was frozen.
Go ahead, Bob. Are you there?
Yeah, is that a foghorn?
That's actually a train. We're getting ready to go back inside. I'm trying. Kathy is my wonderful girlfriend, and she's very much into some of the things I've told her about you and stuff, and she's just kind of listening in the background. So
okay,
go ahead.
So you would put the cement cube back in the water, would energize, purify the water, and then energize the drinker of the water. That's the basic way it's made. Well. That's the D cell. That's Dave Worcester. I first got the D cell from Dave Worcester in 68, 69. And that's when I found his organizations, the Servants of Awareness. He was in Seattle, and they were getting the stuff from Joe Dunslone, who lived in Huntington Park, Los Angeles area. Okay, back. I just did a big interview with Worcester. It's going to be, some of it may be in Paranoia Magazine, the hard copy itself. If not, the whole thing will be up on the website. And you will be able to read about the meaning of Rai returning the place of essence, to the plane of essence. The thing is that consciousness in all levels, not just this plane, but other planes, was altered by that. The love-ins started 2 weeks or a week or so after Rai, the be-ins. The be-ins started January 14, 67, right after Rai returned to essence. All that hippie culture of 67, 68, and then the reaction to that in 69, which Lennon and Yoko had to deal with, and part of the principles, Rai, the male principle, and Isis, the female principle, return both. I saw, at the time, I saw Lennon, the Lennons, that just gotten married,
right.
Them acting out the Rai, Isis, male-female dialectic, which was obsolete. That's why unisex and gay sex and multisex came in since then. The distinction between the sexes melted away with the return of Rai and Isis. So I saw them acting out a Rai and Isis, which is like a priestcraft level of, you know, inspiring awe in people and making a statement about some enemy. And the enemy was the android meme, the beginning stages of the android meme. What we call the media, it's very interesting, people talk about the media did this, the media did that. They talk about it as something out there, and ask them what it is, they might say, well, I guess it's the news. The whole expression by the phrase the media is technically talking about the android meme, which started in the 60s. So it's interesting how people talk about the media, as if it's this uncontrollable force out there, which is a very accurate perception of what the android meme is. So the media was taking after John and Yoko, Rai and Isis, but the media needed that humanistic, human-formed drama before Rai returned to essence, because Rai created the human form. So From that point on, you had celebrity culture, with emphasis on anthropomorphic human beings doing this and that, through the media, for the benefit of the Android meme, which covered their eccentricity or truth. And you could say that the media was naive, the individual journalists were naive, but the Android meme itself, it knew it needed to feed on human content so that people wouldn't notice it. So that's the dialectic back then, and that dialectic goes up till 1990. Then the Android meme disappears. Then you have the after image of the Android meme. It replays the return of Rai to essence. It disappears in 1990. All the walls go down, and then the 90s is the after image is the after image of the Android meme. The proof that the Android meme was dead and no longer powerful is the after image made everybody buy computers to get ready for Y2K. Then nothing happened at Y2K. Okay, showing that the purchasing of the computers was an after image effect, had no real ground. And I predicted that the Y2K would lead to nothing, and it didn't. Then after that, what do you got? You got a bunch of human beings looking at each other, made up of other technologies as their additional organs. So I call it the TV body and the chip body. When I'm talking to you on the chip body now, but I met you in person on the beach, Corbin, it would be me looking at you plus your TV landscape, your chip landscape, and your astral body, which is what that's the Crowleyite. Occult world. So we juggle all these bodies, and so we're looking at each other, and what are we going to use as a reference point? Basically, people get pretty frustrated, turn into cavemen, start bombing each other, suicide or collective. So that's where we're at right now. Lurking in the background is the 2012 myth, right?
Yeah, explain that. I've heard you talk about it before, but mirror image, I get a bit of it. It's just been a while. Refresh my memory.
Well, you know, but the Mayan calendar ends in 2012?
Right.
People wonder through the ages why it does end there. Well, the reason is that they had built up their pretty accurate science on cycles based on friction societies or energy winding down so that you had to replenish the energy. With cold fusion, you don't have to replenish the energy. There's more energy on the output than the input. So that's a frictionless society. So the frictionless society starts coming in around 2012, and the Mayans, all their knowledge, and anybody other culture at that, all through the last 10,000 years was based on friction, they could not calibrate the frictionless situation. So they stopped their calendar, their chart, their knowledge. They ended at 2012. They didn't know why. Well, maybe they kind of knew that something was totally different that they couldn't calibrate, but they did not know what would cause it. They did not know about a cold fusion battery. So we're moved now. What's interesting, the Evergreen stopped channeling in 2004 after 30 years. The actions moved to another group called the Willows, and the Willows have told us that the energies of 2012 are happening right now. This was last year, 2007.
So you're saying the Evergreens stopped channeling in
2004.
All right, let me get a couple notes here. 2004, and now it's the Willows?
Yes, the Willows I discovered last year. They're up in Toronto, like the Evergreens came out of. And I don't know if they're as good as the Evergreens, but they're not bad. So I used them, and they pointed out that the energies, that the things that I was feeling and Connie was feeling were physiological things. And they said, well, you're picking up because you're sensitive to the fact that 2012 is happening now in 2007. So the calendar's like 5 years off. I mean, they're trying to measure something in human time measurements, time calibrations, but it's around now, 5 years, not 4 years, not too far away. So it is happening now. And that's part of the setting up of Dobbstown in Costa Rica.
Give me a minute. There was a couple things you touched on, and because you're so, you get so quick with some of these things, Bob, I have to stop and recollect for a second. You touched on a subject with the 2012 calendar, and it was something that I was going to bring up. I'm getting this.
It's all right. It's overload. It's John and Yoko, Rai, Return to Essence, Aleister Crowley, just repeating some of the buzzwords of what we talked about.
Crowley was obviously very aware of his image, and he was maybe one of the great, what would you call call it, being able to project, making sure that user was the content through most of his students and initiates, but besides having a more or less ceremonial tactics that would unlock a lot of what people would call metaphysical phenomena, occult phenomena, and the argument tends to be whether or not it's a psychological, observation of what actually happens in the mental faculties, as to oppose whether or not these angelic beings actually exist. And now, under electronic environmental media, the fantasy being that we can create these angelic beings, even though it just may be a replay or retrieval of everything that people hold nostalgic. And at the same time, with what's happening politically, with probably the first time in American history, you have a woman running for president, a black man running for president, McCain, who's the oldest candidate if he gets elected, it's more or less, would you think that the angelic environment is not envious in any degree, but why is it this humanity's fascination with trying to create the either pre or post angelic environment through media, electronic means? There's always the sense that, oh, if you could live forever, at what point, that's the vampiric idea that, oh, if I could live for 500 years, well, ultimately, what, moralistically, if there's such a thing, do you get where I'm going with it? I mean, isn't it the ultimate fantasy of the Bill Gates types and whatnot to say, yes, this is something that will live on, and I am creating very now angelic states of being that have never been possible before? Does that make any resonance with you on that level, or?
No, that's a very good question, and very key point. You ask good questions, Corbin, you already have. Here's how I go back. Let's go back to Crowley. He maybe was one of the first media, or first maguses that knew how to play with the media, as simple as it was in the 20s and 30s. Play with the big beast image. But his ideology, the user is the content, is actually what is the manipulative principle of the android meme. Now, I'll leave that, and let's go back to the other point about angelic presences. I think it's Frank Zingroni pointed out that one of the major archetypes in human life is the archetype of perpetual motion, sort of an uninterrupted flow or something. That's been a dream for people to experience that constantly. It's like, Leary's thing, should we ever come down? If you get on a drug and you never have to come down, I think a lot of people would like that. If the drug was a floating, ecstatic experience. So you have that archetype. And now I call that the astral body. That's the belief there's more than this. And what is this? Our physical bodies experience the ups and downs and cycles of the doubleness of emotions. Faithfulness, lustfulness, greed, detachment. All the double ironies, the virtues and vices of humans. We're always wrestling with those contradictory impulses. So
the paradigm aspect, and there is an argument among the occult community right now whether or not something can actually be termed a religion, an ideology, or a spiritual belief, because these become very dangerous subjects. I mean, to impose upon somebody else, ideology is something that everybody can say, well, that is an idea that it is possible. Whether or not it is not. Religion or whatnot is obviously what Marx would say, Lenin or Marx would say, the opiate of the masses. And then dogma creates the evil insurgents or just the political landscape that is, I mean, these are the buzzwords now, insurgency. It is very much the mob. It's been quite a while, Bob, but are you ducking out on this? I know you're filling in for, Mrs. Obama, just to keep an eye on the situation. Tell me about your perceptions on this nonsense going on with this ugly, ugly race where basically the first black man and woman that potentially may end up, United States bound.
Okay, I will address Obama in a minute. I'll just give you a clue. Barack Obama, take the B. Get rid of the dot after B for Barack, and you got OB, which is Bob. And then you got AM, Android Meme, and then the A after that refers to the AP. So my name is right in his name. Bob Barack B, Bobama, is Bob Android Meme A. Look at that. I don't have to infiltrate his wife, I'm right in his name. Okay, so back to the angelization, which I didn't finish. So the ideal of perpetual motion and being an angel, Wyndham Lewis is a key guy in breaking through here because he recognized that through electric media, we are like the angels in the sense that the angels can be wherever they want to be and then they just go there and they're there and then they go somewhere else. That's kind of like no interference state of being. What was different about the radio effect and then TV and the present of media, electric media, is that we're more than angels. We're super angels because we can be everywhere at once. If everybody was listening to this, everybody would be in the room where I am. They'd be in Corbin's room. They'd be in the CIA that's surveilling us. And they'd be in the rooms of all the people listening. And those rooms would be here. We're all in this weird space. That's a super angelic space. We don't need to travel from one place to another like angels, even though they can do it infinitely. We are statically in touch with everything without moving. So that's a new condition. So then you go to the Bible, and apparently it says that the angels were angry that humans invented language. So they couldn't do that. So humans invented language, then all the technologies came from language, and now we have an angelic, we have a new language, the internet, where everybody's everywhere, and they can even drop off and disconnect from it when they want to. We have created a new environment that still trumps the angels. It allows us to be beyond the angels, or to be beyond their characteristics. They probably intuit that at the beginning of time and were pissed that we were going to always be bigger than them through language.
Yeah, but what I'm saying with this new environment, I don't think that people are massively ready to adapt to it, other than the few that can even briefly conceive of what you're trying to relate to them. I think this is what you would call perpetual, more or less perpetual evolution to that point, because it is an ongoing process.
Now let's hold that thought. Now I agree. It's very hard for people to perceive it. You know, the fish doesn't know the new water it's in. But so Crowley was talking about the angelic archetype and playing off with a bit of media response and dialogue. But we're way beyond that. And I think McLuhan updated Crowley's method and pushed it further and more inclusive. And then of course I cap it off with what I do. And I just want to tell you, Walter Boert. You remember Walter Boert, Operation Mind Control?
Yeah, I remember you turning me on to it. Now, refresh my memory, because Kathy's listening too, and a lot of this, she's heard before, but, just kind of keep us up to speed.
Well, the point is that Walter Boert, he had a pretty productive life, did a lot of things, and he created the Operation Mind Control, the CIA using drugs and hypnosis and to train couriers to do something their conscience would, if they were conscious, their conscience would object to. The idea that you could hypnotize someone to do evil. So he died in December. And his colleague, he knew very well the last 7 years, was talking to me a lot after Walter died. And then Walter started communicating to us. So we're in direct communication with Walter. And I'm going to be on Eben Ray's show tonight. It's going to be the first time I'll be in the studio taking calls. So if you want to call in, it would be, you're in Florida?
Yeah.
It would be 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock in the morning, your time.
Alright, one second.
At KPFK. Anyways, the...
It's 3 hours later out here, so you're saying 5 to 7...
Is your time. My time is 2 to 4.
Okay, a.m.
Yeah.
Alright.
Anyways, I'll probably talking about this Walter stuff. I have no problem. I know people think it's nuts. We're in direct talk with Walter. And Walter studied me and McLuhan and all that stuff. We had a long session with him yesterday.
Walter, through a medium, or because he's still alive? Walter passed away, right?
Right. He threw a medium, but the guy is not going to trance. He's conscious, and he just can hear what Walter wants to say.
Right. I get what you're saying. Yeah.
So listen to this. So Walter told us yesterday in a five-hour session that my stuff that I'm talking about is real, the four bodies are real, and the interaction between the electric nature and the electric medium, the electric angels and the electric super angel and the original angels and the original variety is all true. He says it really creates a complex situation involving time. So that was good to get that confirmation from Walter on what I've been doing. So then you come to Hillary and Obama. Now I did an interview, if you go on the internet, go on YouTube, and put in Dobbs and Channer, C-H-A-N-N-E-R. That's for Harold Hudson Channer. I did a taping.
I've seen both shows, I believe.
You saw the one that was just put up last week, May 22nd.
Oh, no, I have not.
That get the latest, and at the very end of a good hour discussion, I lay out the meaning of Obama and Hillary and John McCain. Rather than going into it, just to give you a little homework, get your friend to listen to that whole show. I explain a lot for an hour. In the latest one, people think this is one of the best ones. I've done 10 dialogues with Harold Channer since 2000. But the Obama thing and Hillary thing is at the end. And listen to that. I don't want to say much about it other than that. I'll probably see.
No, yeah, because it gets to be old news and everybody's beating it to death like an old horse or whatever. It will give me some time to come up with some, you know, rather intriguing dialogue because, I mean, there are several things that, you know, that I'd very much like to touch on. Now, in terms of the mediums that you've been working with, the original gentleman through the Evergreen was William Blake Reed, correct?
Michael Blake Reed.
Michael Blake Reed. I'm sorry, it's been a few years.
And you can get his tapes. And see, the point is, you can get all the great stuff, all the public stuff. Get the one, A Day in the Life of a Man in the Year 2078. Get that one. That's not very expensive, I don't think, these transcripts. Or get the tape.
And, right, right.
And there's a lot of stuff there. That's, you know, it's better than Casey.
And
that's Edgar Casey, you know.
Yeah, Edgar Casey, yeah, yeah, obviously. I mean, you know. Now, is that a spinoff of his foundation? Or
no, I'm saying the Evergreens are better than Edgar Casey, who died in 1945.
Right, right.
That's, and people buy Casey's stuff and read his books and all that stuff. Well,
yeah, yeah.
I recommend the Evergreens. It's better.
Right. And they have, what, evergreens.com?
No website. It's the number is 604.
Hold on.
604-536-7402.
Now you're saying that the Willows are the new one you're working with.
Yeah, the Evergreens are 6,500 to 7,000 entities. Well, turns out the
Willows are the one that you've most recently been working with.
Yes, and then the Willows though are 293,000 entities.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I don't know if it's as good as the Evergreens, but it's all we got, and they are pretty good, and they're getting better as I get intelligent clients working on them, and I've had some good sessions with them. That's all I can say about it. Just try it. The Willows, you can Google them. You put in Dave Watson, the Willows, and you'll get his website. Dave Watson, W-A-T-S-O-N, and it's not as expensive as the Evergreens.
Interviews you've done just for your own personal,
Espionage, personal espionage.
Yeah, espionage indeed, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that they're only personal. There's some things they mentioned to me that were pretty interesting. Like they said that I was sitting here with a young person. I did a reading with a bunch of people at this mansion, and then one of the people there, a younger person, wanted to have a private reading but wanted me to be there. So I went there in November 2nd. And so there was mainly the kid asking his questions. And at one point, the Willow said, well, in light of what we said in the last session at the mansion, we talked about how the people are getting incredibly dumbed down. It's getting pretty bad. And I wouldn't say it's dumbed down in my terms, but anyways, like you say, they can't handle the Android meme. So the people are getting pretty freaked out in this situation. They said that that the baby boomers, who were idealistic in the 60s or whatever. Oh, I'm going to sidetrack for a second. The reason that the kids are nostalgic about the 60s and will be forever, because that was when there still was a human form before Rai returned to essence.
What?
So as young kids grow up, they want to believe there's a human dimension, so they go back to the last ecstatic image of human scale. And that's the 60s. So that's why that keeps recycling. Meanwhile, Willows, what was I saying? They were saying that the baby boomers blew it. And that now we're in a situation where if the baby boomers don't retrieve some of that or get some perception of what's going on, we're in trouble, because the younger kids don't have the time to get to the established position. Another 30 years, they would be too late. So it's up to the baby boomers now. And then out of the blue, they said, and Bob, we want you to lead this. Not that I'm a baby boomer, but maybe I understand the baby boomers. And I was thinking, well, how do you lead today? Or that sounds like obsolete terminology. But they picked up on what I was thinking. They said, no, we don't mean being a general. They mean gathering like-minded people together and doing something. I don't know what it is. So I got appointed as part of this last gas revolution. So then a few months later, the young person had another session. So I asked them, before he went to reading, I said, ask him how I'm doing in my leading the revolution. And then we were joking about what the Willows might say, and we said, I'll make it, we said it more slang and curse words, but said the fucking idiot, we imagined they'd say, the fucking idiot blew it. So we were talking about that. So then the guy did have the session, and I said, well, did you ask him about how I was doing? They said, yeah. Did they say I was a fucking idiot? No. You're right on schedule. So I tied that back into Walter. I've got direct communication for no cost with the astral plane via Walter Bauer about this whole issue. He was a leader of the baby boomers. So it's become quite ironic and poetic, the present state of my situation via the Willows.
What's on your agenda? I'd like to give me. I just got in the house. We're running around doing some stuff. Give me a minute to kind of soak in some stuff that I think we'll find intriguing. You've touched on a number of things that are very cool. But give me. Can I call you back within the hour here? You've got some time or what?
Yeah. Call me back in half an hour.
Okay, I'll call you back in a half hour. Give me a minute to kind of figure out some buzzwords. There were some things that I'd...
Yeah, no problem. Look at your notes. Replay it in your head.
Yeah, I'm making some notes even as we speak, Bob. You know, I always tend to do that.
We'll take a commercial break.
We're taking a commercial break, a little interval.
Okay, talk to you later.
Okay, Bob. Okay, man. Talk to you in just a little bit.
Yeah, bye. Oh my God, that's good. Make sure that's off. I can press it.